weeks, or we're spending a long, going to be spending a long time in the book of Genesis. I'm going to try out this lapel one more time. Give it a shot here. Oh, no, I just turned it off. There we go. We're going to be spending a while in a teaching series on the book of Genesis. And to open that up, Renee last week gave kind of her perspective, her take on Genesis 1 through 3. Ron is going to do the same thing next week. And so this week is my week, and I'm trying to, rather than trying to address all of the content that is there, I'm going to try to pull Genesis 1 through 3 into conversation with some other stories. Because sometimes I think that the way that we have read Genesis 1 through 3 in a church setting, if you grew up in one, is kind of like hearing one side of a conversation. We hear these as our stories, ones that tell us about God, creation, people, evil, sin, and so on. But in many ways, only listening to the church version or the church side of these stories is kind of like hearing one side of a conversation. That side of the conversation has become incredibly well-developed. There are lots of different doctrines of creation, understandings of the relationship between creation and science, doctrines of humanity, sin, evil, and so on. I think that putting these stories back in conversation with some of the other creation myths from the ancient world will actually help us hear them more clearly, and that they will give that doing so will give us an opportunity to bring them into conversation with the stories that get told in our world as well. So this is going to be a little bit brief because we had a lot to talk about today, but my first attempt is going to be here to put Genesis 1 through 3 in conversation with the ancient world. Without time to get into specifics, some of these are going to be generalizations of how things work, of how these stories were told, but bear with me. I think one of the aspects of the Genesis creation stories that stands out most starkly in contrast with the ones around it is the lack of violence. Just as one example, the Babylonian creation story, which is depicted up here and which was surely looming large in the time of Genesis's composition because of the Babylonian exile, involves Tiamat on the left there, a primordial sea goddess who creates the first generation of gods with her husband, who then rebel and kill him, at which point she declares war but is eventually killed by Marduk, who's on the right there, who creates the earth and sky out of her body. Please don't convert to ancient Babylonianism. I know it's a super cool story and all, but along with a lot of other of Israel's neighbors and their stories of creation, Genesis 1 does begin with that sort of primordial and actually feminine chaos. Alter calls that welter and waste. That was read last week. But rather than declaring war on it instead of attacking it, the ancient Israelites saw God as working differently in the world. They answered the question of how their God handled chaos and emptiness differently than the people around them. Not that they hadn't experienced their share of violence and destruction in the world, but there seems to be a desire coming through in the stories of Genesis 1 through 3 to insist that peace is more fundamental than violence. That God's work in the world is peaceful, and the violence in the surrounding world was actually counter to that work. And so in Genesis 1, we have God speaking into the chaos, God calling the world into being and establishing a rhythm in creation. Another major contrast with several other ancient creation stories from the ancient world is the place of humanity. Humanity is often pictured as sort of an incidental or even accidental occurrence. Humans were often thought as being brought into being once the gods figured out that they didn't like working and needed someone to tend the wild beasts or tame the land. And so they end up creating humanity as almost an afterthought. Sometimes to disaster, too. Sometimes the gods were known for wiping out humanity if they got too loud. But in both of our stories, both of our creation stories that we have been reading together, humanity is the pinnacle, the peak. In Genesis 1, humanity comes at the climax of the rhythm of Genesis 1. And in Genesis 2, a more space-oriented story, humanity is placed in the very center of that story, with the rest of the world not being able to operate without humanity involved. In Genesis 1 through 3, we hear people as being called to partner with God's work in the world, not to just be subservient to it while God relaxes and takes time off, but we understand through the rhythm of creation in Genesis 1 that God is going to get back to work the following week, and that God has given humanity a special place in that work. Okay, so that was a super brief overview. But I also want to bring Genesis 1 through 3 into conversation with the stories that we tell in our world, to hear it as a part of a conversation that is ongoing and continuing. And interestingly enough, in reflecting on this and thinking on this, one of these ancient myths, I think, remains prominent. Walter Wink kind of calls this out as the myth of redemptive violence. Oops, sorry, that's another humanity picture. That's the gods kind of chilling while people farm. But the myth of redemptive violence. We'll let the imagery soak in for a moment. Yeah, it's amazing how easily you can find it. Like some of these other ancient creation narratives that were told in the ancient world, it seems that our world is kind of bought into the idea that violence is primary in our world. That often the only way to address violence and chaos is with more violence and chaos. We don't seem to have learned our lesson very well over centuries, millennia, that violence only begets more violence. And so bringing Genesis 1 through 3 into conversation with this particular myth means that we have to reconsider what it means for us to claim to worship a God of peace. A God who has set peace at the foundation of the world and who also works in that world in peaceful means. Another striking contrast of this story with a story told in our world is that the limitations of time and space as told in Genesis 1 and 2 are actually brought forward as the conditions for intimacy and for a relationship with God, not as hindrances to it. What I mean by that is, I don't know if you ever experience this, as I often do, but we are often, I think, pressured in our world and pressured in our lives to extend our human boundaries, to work in ways that are beyond our limits. We often find ourselves frustrated with limited time, with not being able to be in two places at once, like I would have liked to be all morning this morning, and feel that often those things are hindrances in our relationship with God. If only we had more time to connect with God. If only we had the space that we needed, if our worlds were arranged in such a way that they centered on God, on worship of God, then we would be okay. Or if we were able somehow to transcend the limitations of time and space, we would be able to connect with God in a purer way. But the stories of Genesis 1 and 2 explicitly reject this myth, which may be thought of as kind of a very boiled down in modern Plato. Genesis 1 affirms that time, the rhythms that we find in our universe, are a part of the way that God created the world and are an important part of how God interacts with humanity. We hear these parallel days come together in a rhythm leading up to the seventh day of rest, which gets emphasized in a way that none of the other days do. As I said earlier, we hear God establishing this not just as a one-time thing, but assuming that it would take place the next week and the next week and the next week. That God and ourselves would be given time for work and for rest, and that is within those conditions that God and humanity could find one another, could establish a relationship with one another, could love one another. The way we've talked about evil is often confusing. There are different stories, different ways of explaining evil in the world that are prominent today. Some people want to think of evil as entirely external to humanity. Some people want to put it entirely internal to humanity. And some people want to blame it on women everywhere for all time. I think bringing this back into a closer reading of Genesis 1 through 3, and especially of chapter 3, which I don't have time to walk through that particular reading today, but I think bringing those kinds of stories into conversation with our stories, or stories we've claimed as our own, can help us see what's wrong with some of that. Because the story, especially the one told in Genesis 3, is much more ambiguous than we might have been taught. We're told about a talking snake who... James Charlesworth in one of my seminars in undergrad wrote, and we read an 800-page book about him basically saying that snakes are kind of a sometimes good, sometimes bad kind of figure. there's a summary to save you some time. But we have been often taught to interpret the snake as the devil who tempts Eve, who then, you know, passes this sinful action along to Adam. And the reality is that we don't really understand what's being told in this story. That clearly something bad has happened, that some kind of disruption comes into the relationship between God and humanity. Perhaps the snake represents a remnant of that primordial chaos that has kind of lingered on in the world. Perhaps it's just a part of creation. I think our experience affirms some of this ambiguity. Sometimes we need help in doing bad things. Sometimes we definitely don't. And so I think bringing Genesis 1 through 3, a closer reading of this, which we'll kind of continue to engage, actually brings us the possibility of rejecting some of the stories that were told about evil in our world, particularly the ones that tend to marginalize or oppress particular groups of people, in this case, especially women. We're allowed to consider the ways that evil works in our lives, the ways that we experience it. And we're allowed to hear and try to appreciate and understand the responses that God has to it in these stories. As I said earlier, the creation stories of Genesis 1 through 3 have often been brought into conversation with science, and so I'm going to take on Einstein today. Not really. Einstein was fond of saying that God does not play dice with the universe, and this was a way of him, like, so just so you know I understand this, this was a way of him saying that he thought that there was some kind of, you know, underlying unity to the theories of relativity and the physics that had come before it, and I understand all that, but I wish he had just kind of stayed in his lane. Which means that he was a great physicist, but not much of a theologian. Because I think if Einstein had read Genesis 1 through 3, we would see he would have seen that creation was actually an enormous risk for God. That we don't get a picture of a God who knows exactly how everything is going to work out, has an exact plan in place, and knows exactly how to fix it. Theologians, with more help from Greek philosophy than Hebrew scriptures, developed all kinds of theories about God creation ex nihilo, about the fall, and about original sin, and all these kinds of things. But the story is one of God putting God's own self at risk, of opening up the world of creation for the possibility of enormous good, but also opening to the possibility of enormous evil. And within that, rather than coming up with a plan that encompasses that all, God has just committed to humanity. Whatever the outcome is, God remains in relationship with humanity. God maintains God's love towards humanity. And the story goes on. The story, God continues to offer opportunities that open themselves to that same kind of risk, that open themselves to the possibility for good and the possibility for evil. So I want to reflect, there they are again, Are you fighting me back there? Okay. I want to reflect going into communion and say that it's really no wonder that John and some of the earlier Christians saw parallels between the work of God in creation and the work of God through Jesus in establishing and inaugurating a new creation. They looked at Jesus and saw the same kind of approach towards evil and chaos in the world, that Jesus maintained a peaceful message, a peaceful lifestyle, that Jesus spoke into the chaos of his own context and situation rather than choosing to attack it violently to take the paths that some of his contemporaries were taking. Jesus places humanity at the center of his story, demonstrated through his ministry and his teachings a deep love and a deep care for humanity, especially those who had been marginalized by others. Jesus represents but also extends invitations to join in God's work, not believing that humanity is simply there to do God's work for God or to kind of muddle around and find their way in the dark while God does something mysterious and beyond understanding, but that humanity has a special place in the work that God is doing in the world and can join in that. Jesus' own limitations in time and space, as we see around Advent, are in one way an affirmation of those limitations. They're God's way of blessing time and space by putting God's whole self within those same limitations and boundaries, demonstrating that the kind of love, infinite love and grace that God has for humanity can be worked out in the conditions of time and space in a particular culture and language. And ultimately, Jesus, in many ways, it was God's biggest risk. God putting everything on the line in a human baby, opening up the doors for the possibility of and realization of evil in the crucifixion, but also opening the possibility for a more fundamental affirmation and realization of the good in creation, the very goodness of creation in the resurrection. And Jesus took another risk, following in that line, by handing this work off, by handing the new creation that had been inaugurated off to us, calling us to the same kind of peaceful life that he led, rejecting the violent messages, the myths of redemptive violence in the world around us, calling us to that same love of humanity, especially those who have been oppressed and marginalized, calling us to partner in God's work with Jesus and within our limitations, our time and space-bound bodies and persons. To know that in taking the risk of joining in God's work, we're opening ourselves up to the possibility of evil. Really, just by living, we're opening ourselves up to that possibility. But also to the possibility of incredible good. Good beyond anything we could imagine on our own that could only come from partnering in God's work with God. And so the invitation today to the communion tables that are around the back of the room is in many ways an invitation to take that same risk. The risk that God took at creation, the risk of Jesus in new creation that we continue. To risk the possibility that things will go terribly, terribly wrong. That we are on entirely the wrong path, that we will mess things up very badly, as we have before, and probably will again. But also opening ourselves up to the possibility that God will work in and through our limitations, that God will work in and through even the evil that happens as a result of these risks, and that God will bring something out of our lives, out of our community life together, that's better than we could possibly imagine. So I'll say a prayer and then feel free to move to the back to take communion as you feel led. God, we thank you. We thank you for taking the risk you took in creating our world, the risk you took in sending Jesus, and the risk that you continue to take by partnering with us to carry out your work in the world. We ask for the faith that it takes to take that same risk, to join you in that work. We ask that you not only protect us from, but also forgive us for the times that inevitably turns out wrong, that evil comes out of our attempts to live as you would have us live. We pray that you bless and affirm and guide us increasingly into the good that you have for us, that you help us, strengthen us to continue following in your ways. And we thank you for Jesus, who is not only an example of that, but who makes it possible for us to do all of that. So it's in his name we pray.